You're listening to the free abridged edition of the Energy Transition Show.
Oil, coal, hydro, nuclear energy, natural gas,
energy infrastructure,
solar power,
wind turbines.
Remember, you're effectively rebuilding two giant industries of the 20th century, and rebuilding them is not going to be cheap.
This is really a grassroots movement. It's not necessarily big companies shipping modules to markets in Africa. It's often local entrepreneurs putting up solar systems.
For April 17th, 2024, this is the Energy Transition Show with Chris Nelder. This is our third episode in a three-show mini-series on green industrial policy. In episode 220, we heard how capitalist entrepreneurs are building on green industrial policy to scale up energy transition solutions to meet the climate challenge. In episode 221, we discussed why the biggest package of green industrial policy ever in the United States was called the Inflation Reduction Act, and why direct government intervention is necessary both at the head of the process, through investment incentives, and at the tail, through controlling inflation. And in this episode, we wrap up the mini-series with an historical and analytical look at green industrial policy from the perspective of an economist who has written a book on the subject and advocated for green industrial policy in the EU. Dr. Alessio Terzi is an economist with the European Commission who works at the intersection of academia, policy, and think tanks. He's also a lecturer in public policy at Cambridge University and an adjunct professor in economics at Sciences Po and at HEC Paris. He also worked in the European Central Bank's EU Institutions Division and in sovereign risk analysis for BMI Research. He is the author of numerous articles in major news publications, as well as a book titled Growth for Good. In today's conversation, we'll discuss why technological transformation is the essential pathway to solving our climate problems, and why capitalism and growth are core to that process. We'll also discuss the degrowth concept and some of the critiques of capitalism, along with some ways that capitalism can be improved and adapted to the task of answering the climate challenge. And we'll wrap it up with Alessio's Blueprint for Green Capitalism. It's a heady, 90-minute excursion into economic theory and green industrial policy that I hope will answer the questions some of you have about the wisdom of using the tools of capitalism and growth to make the energy transition successful. Then in the news segment, we'll check out a thermal storage project supporting a district heating network. We'll note a new effort to use waste heat from a subway system. We'll hail the new and largest solar and battery system in the U.S. We'll celebrate a record-breaking year for solar and storage in the U.S. And we'll see how battery prices are coming along. And now, our conversation with Alessio Terzi, recorded March 12, 2024. So let's bring him into the conversation now. Welcome, Alessio, to the Energy Transition Show.
Thank you.
You've written fairly extensively on green industrial policy and what you've called the green industrial revolution that is now underway. Much of that, of course, is about the energy transition. And along with Roger Fouquet, you co-authored an interesting article in EconPol Forum last year in which you draw some useful insights about the present energy transition from energy transitions of the past. So to get us started here, I wonder if you could just kind of share a few of those insights.
Yes, absolutely. I guess the beginning of the reflection is what we were trying to do, which is to realize that in order to reach net zero, we will basically need to transform the whole of production and consumption. And that is because we currently live in something that is close to a fossil fuel civilization. Now, in practice, that means that we have to transform the whole of energy generation, transport, housing, agriculture, and much more. So it sounds very daunting, but actually when we look back, this has happened before in history and notably during industrial revolutions. And so that is a bit when we started our collaboration with Roger, we said, okay, but with the appropriate caveats, is there anything we can learn from the past when we're trying to inform ourselves about climate policy for the 21st century? And the answer turned out to be yes. So in light of that, we focused a bit more on energy transformations. And so that is why at the heart of this paper you were mentioning, there are energy transformations. I rest a lot on the commendable work of my co-author, Roger Fouquet, who has devoted a lot of his life at looking at the history of energy. And he looked in particular at the last 1,000 years and energy transformation that have happened over the last 1,000 years. Things like the transition from animals to steam power, from steam to electricity, from sail to steamships, from candles to gas lighting, from gas lighting to electricity, and so on. And in all of the 14 energy transitions that took place in the past 1,000 years, the impetus to switch to different sources of energy was that there was a new source that was cheaper and typically also displayed better services for consumers. And this is important to realize as a starting point. In every case, the method of energy supply had to change. And what this entailed is that there had to be a major infrastructure investment. But nonetheless, we look also at how long these transformations took. And in the best cases, they actually happened around 30 years at the least, which is reassuring to a certain extent, because that is more or less the time horizon we have between now and 2050, roughly mid-century, in order to completely transform our energy systems and reach net zero. So again, history, to a certain extent, gives us hope that this can be done. Now, again, to make sense a bit of what we are trying to achieve and learn from past history of energy transformations, we can, at an abstract or theoretical level, we can see that there are three major pathways to decarbonization. One is voluntary reductions in energy consumption. This goes also under the name of sobriety and demand reductions of energy. The second channel is efficiency improvements. And the third channel is technological transformations. So sobriety, efficiency improvements, and technological transformation. Historically, the first two pathways have demonstrated limited efficacy. What this means is that we can hope to have some voluntary reductions in energy consumption. We can hope that people will decide not to take planes as much or will decide to turn down their heating a little bit. This is possible, but it will have a limited impact. The times historically that this has happened to a larger extent is typically if there is a large social concern. If you're at a time of war, and you're asking people to engage in a personal sacrifice in the interest of the common cause or of the nation, that is when you obtain some results on voluntary demand reductions. But this is typically limited in time, and it can only happen in very specific circumstances. The second channel, we said, is efficiency improvements. There again, the history of energy transformations, or the history of energy in general, is full of examples of efficiency improvements. So we can absolutely hope that there will be efficiency improvements this time around as well. But it is important to realize that eventually these give way to rebound effects. And so that efficiency improvements, again, historically have not led to a reduction in energy use, for example, because eventually they have led to cheaper prices of energy and so a greater use of energy. And so on that front, we're also less hopeful, which leaves the third channel and technological transformations as the crucial pathway to achieve a green transition, to decarbonize our economy, and so open the gateways of what I've been calling a green industrial revolution.
That makes a lot of sense. And in fact, we've talked about rebound effects many times previously on the show. The research that I've seen on rebound effects indicates that they are real, but they're not 100%. So efficiency does, in fact, result in lower energy demand on net. Is that your understanding as well?
Absolutely. I guess the difference between the literature that you are mentioning and the literature I'm reading as well is the time horizon. And so a lot of the research has been carried out over shorter time horizons. And indeed, it seems that the efficiency improvements are so large, especially within a selected category, that they are leading to demand reductions. A classic example is on lighting, where LEDs are so much more efficient than overall electricity use for lighting has been going down for households, for example. What the argument I have been making is more on a civilizational scale, let's say, and over long periods of time, meaning decades to centuries, and saying, look, it is very unlikely that as a civilization, as a society overall, we will do this by just becoming more and more efficient in energy uses, because eventually the fact that energy is available, abundant and cheap will lead innovation to use more energy itself, and so to new uses of energy if it is cheaply available. And if we want to relate it to what is happening now, perhaps we could see it or say that it is happening to an extent with the digital transition, with AI. And now there are a lot of articles these days coming out and saying, oh, but data centers and AI are projected to have a huge use of energy, potentially as much as Japan within a decade or two. And so that is just a testament to the fact that if energy is available, new innovation will rely on greater uses of energy.
Yeah. And of course, there are some natural limits to how much energy we could consume or would want to consume. Just because LED lighting is cheap doesn't mean that I want to light up my living room like a football stadium.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why within a specific category, you will reach some limits. I guess my argument is across categories. So yes, people will not transform their house in Las Vegas, but they might be using electricity for other uses if, again, it is cheaply available. What you're saying is there are limits to how much energy or electricity we can harvest, and that, again, might be true, but it would be reflected in prices. And so, again, prices would go up, and then there would be a push for greater efficiency. And it is a bit this balancing and rebalancing that has happened throughout the centuries.
Sure. But I think your main point is well made, that technological transformations are the main pathway that we have to go down to decarbonize our society. So what's the role of consumers in the energy transition?
So to my mind, consumers are central. As in, we were saying earlier on that if there is one pattern that we've seen throughout past energy transitions, it is this idea that you need a new technology, and that the new technology will be seen as superior. Now, this superiority, just like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder, and here specifically in the eyes of the consumer. And so we need consumers to attach value to the green option, to the decarbonized option, to the less polluting option. And it is fine if the green technology is initially more expensive. Again, this is a pattern that we've seen throughout past energy transitions. This is a pattern that we see throughout technological change more broadly. The new option becomes available. It is more expensive. For some reason, it is seen as superior. But the fact that initially some consumers are willing to pay a green premium or a higher price for the new option, in our case, for decarbonized the energy source or the green good, is important, because it means that it brings firms towards this niche. It leads them to scale up production, and as they scale up production, they improve, again, the efficiency of the new option until the point it reaches price parity. When it reaches price parity, then the new technology can spread throughout the whole of society and eventually replace the incumbent. And that is why, to my mind, the early phase in which we are in really relies on people having, let's say, green values, or valuing the green option and seeing it as superior. If they do that, this allows other parts of society, including businesses, to move and innovate and provide the green options.
So if consumers need to embrace the green values or the green attributes of things, obviously, the important task for those of us working on the energy transition is to communicate those values to them and get them interested. I wonder if you could share some of the insights you discussed in your 2020 paper for energy policy about communications techniques that social science shows are effective in persuading the public.
Absolutely. Again, perhaps just one word on the genesis of that paper, which is that for the longest of time, the idea was that you just had to make people aware of climate change, and that then action will follow, that they would naturally change their behavior. Now, this has not been the case. By now, we know, we run surveys across the globe, and majorities in various continents, in various nations, are aware of climate change. Many of them, again, majorities, are concerned about climate change, But this does not translate automatically in people changing their behavior. And so this gulf that opened between knowledge and action has spurred a huge literature, a literature that spans across disciplines from social psychology to anthropology to sociology and other behavioral economics. And so what I've tried to do is to collect a lot of this literature and then distill it in some policy recommendations. As you were saying, how can we use this knowledge to improve our communication, to lead people to change their behaviors on climate change? And from there, we reach 6 fundamental points. And these are the following. First, it is fundamental to highlight local and regional impacts of climate change if you want to spur action. We often see, if you go on Google Images and you look for climate change, the first pictures you will find are typically those of a polar bear or the North Pole or things like this. Those pictures, research has shown, do not lead people to change their action in the immediate. They can generate some sort of empathic reaction on the spot, but they don't lead to behavioral change. The second fundamental point is we have to reduce temporal distances. What this means is that you and I, as pundits, as experts in this field, read the literature, and a lot of the literature on climate change is typically focused on 2100. And so you look at things like the impact of climate change and the impact this will have on sea level rising between now and 2100 and so on. That does not work on people if you want to lead them to change their behavior. Again, research suggests that people have at most a 10-year time horizon. Beyond 10-year horizon, it is a unit of measurement that doesn't make immediate sense to them. And so you have to focus on the immediate impact, which again you can do because climate change is already showing its devastating impact at the moment through extreme weather events, through wildfires, through droughts and floods. And so you can focus your messaging and the attention of your audiences on what is happening right now without having to rely on very long-term projections. You want to link all of this to personal benefits. Highlight that there are personal benefits in taking actions that are also climate friendly. A classic example, telling people that if they take their bike, this is actually in their interest as well. It is better for their health. It improves the local air quality, all things that matter to them personally, directly and immediately, rather than framing personal actions as a loss. And so being like, you really like your steak, but you're gonna take one for the team because this is in the interest of society, of humanity, of future generations. Again, that does not really work at large scale to change behaviors. You want to highlight concrete actions and their effects. So you can use a message of fear, and on climate change, there is sufficient ground to generate messaging based on fear. But the problem is that this works to raise people's attention. So that is good to catch the attention of people. But if you don't show them a way to get out of this corner, you're putting them into a corner with fear, they will use psychological techniques to reduce this fear factor. And they will engage in all sorts of behaviors. A classic example is fatalism, with sentences like, oh, but we will all die in any case, so no point in me not eating a steak or not driving as much or whatnot.
Right.
You will hear people say, I'm too busy. You'll hear people say, yeah, I could do something, but what about China? What about India? What about Europe? What about the rich? What about somebody else? And then not doing, and so on. So you've got to give people agency. You want to manage uncertainty. There's a lot of research out there that obviously has margins of uncertainty. Uncertainty can be a weapon and it can be a problem. So you want to manage this uncertainty that is surrounding, let's say, climate projections and so on. And finally, an important point is targeting. We do targeting of messaging in politics. We do it in marketing. And therefore, we should do it on climate policy as well, rather than treat consumers as a bubble, as a unique group, to realize that actually what works on Democrats in terms of messaging might not work on Republicans, what works on Gen Z younger cohorts might not work on older cohorts, the rich or the poor, and so on, urban versus non-urban populations and so on. So you want to keep all of that in mind, and there is research that looks at what works best in which setting.
Mm-hmm. I guess if I had to sort of summarize everything you just said there, it would be that we should make our messages as personal and direct and immediate and relevant to people as possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because people aren't really good at relating their own actions to broader societal needs or objectives, and they're not very good at relating what happens to them in the immediate term with things that might happen over the long term and so on. So I think those are important insights, and I'm glad that you wrote that paper and distilled some of that social science literature for us, because I just think it can't be emphasized enough that, as you put it, quote, values, beliefs, and emotions represent the lenses through which individuals decipher information, end quote. Because very few lay people are ever going to become expert on the technical aspects of the energy transition, or decide to participate in it or not, based on a neutral scientific consideration of the data, but they absolutely will follow the examples set by their neighbors and the people in their social circles. I feel like I could say that over and over every single show, and I still wouldn't be overdoing it. And I love the quote that you used to open your article in EconPol Forum, which I'll read out here. Quote, what experience and history teaches us is that people in governments have never learned anything from history or acted on principles deduced from it. That's Georg Hegel. Great quote. So moving on from consumers now, what's the role of government in the energy transition? We hope you've enjoyed this free sample of the Energy Transition Show. Our full episodes cover much more and are typically 60 to 90 minutes long. When you become a full annual subscriber, you'll get 2 new complete episodes each month, access to our entire back catalog, extensive show notes, interview transcripts, the text of the news items for each episode, and access to our exclusive job board. Your premium members-only subscription will work in all apps and players that support podcast feeds, including Apple Podcasts and Pocket Casts, so you can easily listen from your mobile device on the go. The first 33 episodes of the Energy Transition Show were free, and always will be, so if you want to see what our full shows contain, feel free to check those out. Then we hope you'll become a member and support our show. In order to bring you the most unfiltered, unbiased, honest information possible, we have elected not to take any sponsors or advertisers. The Energy Transition Show is entirely supported by listener subscriptions. To become a subscriber and enjoy our full offerings, just point your browser to energytransitionshow.com and click the Become a Member button. Annual subscriptions, which include full access to our entire back catalog of full-length episodes, are just $60 a year. Monthly subscriptions are $6.99 a month and give you access to the 2 most recent episodes. Single episodes can be purchased for $7 each. We also offer discounted annual subscriptions for individual university students and professors, as well as group licenses for companies, nonprofits, and universities. So join us today and support our ad-free podcast featuring high-quality, cutting-edge interviews and news about the most important story of our time, energy transition. And now a quick look at some recent news items. Item 1. Pornanjan, a town in southern Finland, is deploying a so-called sand battery to store thermal energy to support the town's district heating system in winter. It's expected to come online within a year, at which point it will be the world's largest sand battery. The sand battery will enable residents to eliminate oil from their district heating network, reduce wood chip burning by 60%, and cut the system's emissions by nearly 70%. The company behind the project, Polar Night Energy, first deployed a unit about one-tenth the size in May 2022 at the Vatanyankoski power plant in a town called Kankanpa. Launched just as Russia cut off gas supplies in retaliation for Finland joining NATO, the project was a timely example of how renewable energy could be harnessed and stored as heat. The sand inside the silo at Kankanpa can store heat at around 500 C for several months. That long duration, as well as the sand battery's capacity to absorb large amounts of energy, makes it superior to electric storage in lithium-ion batteries for applications like district heating systems. The sand is made of crushed soapstone produced by a Finnish company as a byproduct of manufacturing heat-retaining fireplaces. A tall tower is filled with the sand and then heated with resistive heating, like an electric baseboard heater, using energy produced by wind and solar. Using a heat exchanger, the sand battery heats air that is then used to warm the water that circulates through the district heating network. Homes, offices, and even the local swimming pool all make use of the heat. Having refined his charging algorithms on the sand battery in Kangkanpa, Polar Night Energy is now scaling it up to 1 megawatt for use in Pornainen. With a storage capacity of 100 megawatt hours, the battery will be able to meet almost 1 month of heat demand in summer or 1 week in winter. Polar Night Energy is now reportedly setting its sights on building storage systems 100 times larger around the world as fast as possible. Item 2. As longtime listeners will be well aware, I'm very bullish not just on heat storage technologies, but also systems that make use of waste heat. In previous episodes, I mentioned a pilot project in Islington, a London neighborhood which extracts waste heat from the... Well, that's it for this episode of the Energy Transition Show. Thanks for listening. You can find our show archive and give us feedback and suggestions at energytransitionshow.com. On social media, you can follow us on Mastodon at transitionshow@mastodon.energy or on Twitter at transitionshow. Chris Nelder creates the show, Kevin Melsheimer edits it and makes us all sound brilliant, and Justin Ritchie produces our listener experience. Mike Sugar composed and produced our theme music, and you can find him at mikesugarmusic.com. The Energy Transition Show is a production of the XE Network.